My name is Chris Deasy. Welcome to the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My guest this week is Adele Reinhartz, professor in the Department of Classics and Religious Studies in Canada at the University of Ottawa. We talk about our shared interest in the field of religion and film. We learn that Adele grew up in a secular Jewish household and ended up majoring in university in Jewish studies. We discuss whether Judaism is a religion or should be configured as an identity. We talk about a recent film on Christ figures that Adele has seen at the cinema, Judas and the Black Messiah. We talk about her teaching approach, whether and how to screen a film to her students. She talks about her love of going to the movie, something that her parents did, she does, and she takes her grandchildren to. She tells us about her most indelibly etched experience of going to the movies, which involves The Jungle Book, and we discuss why people enjoy sad movies. We learn that Adele wouldn't want to go back to any previous part of her life. We discover what was the first LP that she was given. It was by Simon and Garfunkel. Adele also reveals that she does choral singing with virtual choirs in Britain. We find out how she ended up in academia. She considered other career paths early in her PhD, including going to law school. We find out that she didn't have a burning passion to go into academia. We learn that she's not really a nostalgic person. We talk about how teaching has changed due to the pandemic, why nostalgia is a complicated business, and we learn at the end of the interview why Adele can't watch films about dementia or the Holocaust, and we discover whether she is still in touch with friends from her past. It was an immense privilege to catch up with Adele Reinhartz for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My name is Chris Deasy. So it is such a pleasure to catch up with Adele Reinhartz. And it is such a pleasure, Adele, as we were just saying before we started recording, we very much known each other over the years, not least through the various very similar research interests that we have. And what a pleasure this afternoon to finally get a chance to talk person to person.
Yes, I'm happy about it as well.
And do you want to say a little bit, Adele, about where you're based?
I am sitting here in a suburb of Ottawa, which is the capital of Canada. Yeah. That's where I'm based. I'm at the University of Ottawa. I'm a professor in the Department of Classics and Religious Studies, currently a chair of the department, but not for much longer, just till the end of June.
Yeah, and it's funny because I first came across your work in the Journal of Religion and Film, and it would have been, maybe it was just after I did my PhD, but certainly in the early 2000s, and there were various pieces which I thought were really exciting because in a way, your journey was very similar to mine as somebody who had done no work with film, enjoyed film for entertainment purposes, but had never really sort of seen it as something that could be used for academic purposes. And then I think you were saying that somebody had suggested that you look at a few biblical epics, and suddenly before you knew it, you developed this whole database effectively.
Yeah, well, what happened was I was teaching at McMaster University at the time, and we were asked in our department to dream up courses that might attract a large number of students. All has to do with the algorithm of how departments are funded. And I thought, well, you know, I like movies. I could do this very naively, of course. And so I began teaching in the area, and that soon became a research interest. And this was still at a time when it wasn't quite clear that one could be a serious scholar and study popular culture. There was still, you know, a sense of, you know, high culture, yes, art, drama, classical music, of course, but film, television, not so much. That's changed, of course, but that was still the case 25 years or so when I first began doing this.
Yeah, and I was at a conference in Oxford probably about 15, 20 years ago, and someone there said exactly the same thing, that he had to write a serious book based on the New Testament, and then he could like throw in a film-based book, but he needed the serious books in order to sort of be allowed to have that, what was seen as an indulgence. And right. And it's very interesting because I always used to feel quite defensive when I used to say to people that my PhD was
on religion and film. And it's almost as though I felt this need, and maybe it was just coming from within rather than anybody else sort of questioning the integrity of what I was doing. But it was almost that sense that if film is all about entertainment and you're studying something entertainment based for your PhD, then is it a proper PhD? But right. That helped me because it made sure that I was even more rigorous. And every time I used to question whether I was doing everything really with that sort of integrity, of course, it would make me go back to the books on my shelves and just sort of almost then ensure that I was doubling up. And so that sort of methodology was very much in place.
There's still people who feel that way, but I think it's much less the case.
Yeah. And of course, your work with the Bible as well. And I have to say, because my students, we always use some of your work, maybe from the Routledge Companion to Religion and Film or Jesus of Hollywood. And they love all the different typologies of Mary Magdalene and Judas and Jesus. Yeah. And you framed it in a very different sort of way to many of the other books. So I think in that sense, it's one of the genuinely one of the more accessible books. And it's worth saying as well, of course, I've so enjoyed working with you on the, I think, again, it was for Routledge, wasn't it? When we had, was it the 100 film? That you were studying, the 100.
Oh, it was 50. 50 key films.
Yeah, and I collab. I think I did one on Clint Eastwood. I think it was.
Yeah, Grant, that's Carino. Right. And, I forget which film, but yeah, that's right.
And yeah. Cape Fear was the other. But let's go back, because obviously we're talking about nostalgia. And in terms of things like your childhood, earliest memories, because obviously we know you as a very reputable professor of classics and religious and biblical studies. But how did the journey start for you? What do you remember most from growing up? What were the sort of things that really excited you from a young age?
I would say the things that excited me from a young age had no bearing on, you know, what I ended up doing for my career. What did I love? I loved running around, you know, doing the little girl things that one did in the 50s and early 60s. You know, I was very active and non-athletic. So that's a combination that I still maintain. That's still, you know, absolutely inept at anything athletic, but enjoying, you know, activity. I loved popular music. I loved going to the movies, things like that. I grew up in a very secular Jewish household, completely non-religious. Didn't do any of the Jewish holidays or anything like that. And at university, I thought I should learn something about, it's not that I didn't know anything about Jewish stuff, but it just wasn't about religious observance or aspects that we might call religion. So I started taking courses and ended up majoring in Jewish studies, which at that time was under the rubric of religious studies. So by default, I got a degree in religious studies, couldn't figure out what to do after finishing. So I thought, oh, you know, I'll go for an MA, and then kind of got absorbed with that and ended up in biblical studies professionally. But I would say there was nothing in my childhood that would have led to that in any direct way.
Yeah, and it's funny because a similar sort of path here, because I suppose nominally Anglican. It's funny that yesterday we had our census in the UK. Every 10 years we have to give all this data, and actually it's always the worst question that can come up when you're asked for your religious affiliation, because the option of no religion is there, but also Christianity and Buddhism and Islam and so on. But it's people like me who do this professionally, who study religion, who find it harder to know sometimes quite which box to tick. You mentioned secular Judaism, and actually I was just teaching a course on an introduction to Judaism with my students, but it's funny because I look at those questions and I kind of feel that sometimes the professional and the personal, and you know, what I may have said 30 years ago when I just blind, you know, went to a local Anglican church and didn't really know what I was worshipping, and now I study this professionally, that no doubt catapulted me into the academic study, but then that question of faith, conviction or persuasion is one of the hardest questions to answer, because yeah, you can see it from so many different perspectives.
Well, yeah, and it's also, I mean, certainly, you know, for Jews, it's also, you know, this age-old question of whether Judaism is a religion or not, because, you know, Judaism is a kind of identity that for some people is configured religiously and for other people it's not, and everything in between. So when they're asking about your religion, if you're a non-practicing Jew, like now I am a somewhat practicing Jew, but you know, I didn't grow up that way. But if you are a non-practicing Jew, what do you put down? because it's not really your religion, but it's your identity. So if you say no religion, then you're denying your Jewishness. But if you say Judaism, then other people understand that as your religion, but you don't see yourself that way. So it's just, these questions are very poorly framed. They should really ask, it's the same here when we do our census, they should really ask religious studies scholars.
To write the question.
Yeah, for advice on how to frame these sorts of questions to get at what they really want to know.
Yeah. And that's so interesting because, of course, you've done a lot of work as well in the area of Christ figures and it's the ubiquity of the concept. And that, I think, is also really intriguing in terms of the kind of a rationale sometimes behind those sort of the word quest, I think, is appropriate in that context, but I'm very much part of it as well. But of course, it raises all these questions about the interplay between going to something entertainment based like the cinema and what that has to do with the study of religion. But you're right at the heart of that kind of debate.
Yeah, it's quite interesting. Right now, this minute, or like before our conversation, I'll continue afterwards. I'm in the process of preparing a second edition of my book, The Introduction to Bible and Cinema, that Routledge put out at the same time as they put out that 50 Key Films. And so I'm working now on the chapter on Christ films. So I've been going over again the whole debate, you know, going back to something that you wrote a long time ago. And there's been some more recent work on that about, you know, why do people look for these figures? How do you know when you meet one? What are the criteria? Are we really overdoing it? Like, what's the point of the whole thing anyway? So, and I'm revising that chapter in light of just having seen the film Judas and the Black Messiah. Have you seen that movie?
No, it hasn't come out yet here because I'm hoping it will have a cinema release.
Yeah, well, we're not going to the cinema here. Our cinemas are closed, but we were able to rent it on a streaming platform. And it's fascinating. It's really fascinating because the title itself tells you everything you need to know about the characters and about the plot. And it's based on historical events. So if you know those historical events, you also know what the story is about. And so that's just very interesting, you know, as a viewer to go into the film with these very direct clues and the filmmaker, the cinematography and the editing actually play that up. So you know from the beginning what's going to happen. So it just creates a very interesting viewing experience, kind of like reading the Gospels, because you know how it's going to end and it has to end a certain way because that's how it ended. So your ability to, so that really affects how you process the film and how you experience it.
Yeah.
So I hope you get a chance to see it. It's very interesting.
No, I'd love to, because I saw in the Oscar nominations when they came out a week ago that was very much in the frame.
That's right.
And it is interesting, isn't it? Because you've got sometimes the way in which ancient stories kind of, for many people, are stuck in a certain vacuum, but also a film will come out and there's no way you can ever read that same text in the same way again. And that too, I mean, that for me is always what excited me in the research. And sometimes with the Christ figure material, I was aware that it's very easy to get very carried away. But in a way, these are very familiar tropes and filmmakers are overtly drawing on them in some cases, not for whatever agenda,
it's not subtle. It's not, you know, and that was my, you know, that was something in my work on Bible and film that I was very insistent on it. You know, there are lots of books out there on, you know, biblical themes, redemption, life, death. And I was saying, well, those are themes like of life. So those are everywhere. So you need something more. You need something more explicit if you're going to label a movie discuss a movie in light of its biblical connections. There has to be something explicit that allows you to say that this is woven into the film. So you have a film like Judas and the Black Messiah, it's kind of, you know, it's a no-brainer because, you know, it's right there. But I think that filmmaker, and so what, you know, one of the interesting questions, or one of the questions that's interested me, is why do we still have this, especially in American film, which is what I've studied the most, given the obviously declining levels of biblical literacy and the increasing diversity of the population, which means that not everybody was raised with these with these images and these stories. You know, it's not like in my, you know, in the 20th century, you know, when I went to school, okay, Jewish kid, but really we were inundated. You know, we said that we were supposed to say, some of us didn't say, the Lord's Prayer at school, and we were taught all the stories and all of that. So we absorbed it anyway, but that's not the case anymore. So why do we still have these tropes quite explicitly woven into these films? I think it says something about the deeply embedded nature of the Bible in American society, so that it circulates and it percolates even kind of in culture generally, even despite the lowering biblical literacy among the population. Yeah. Anyway, that's one of the things I'm looking at right now. But that's an interesting movie from that respect. And it's kind of frustrating. We also looked at the Oscar list, but of course, some of the films aren't available in Canada either. Yeah. In any way, anywhere. They haven't been released yet.
Yeah, this is the first year for me where I don't think I've seen any of the films that are on the list, maybe one, but certainly because obviously the cinema's been in a precarious state over here for the last year. But normally you'd have the Oscar nominations in January, and all the films, the studios would be releasing all their films consideration in December, January. So you'd have that period up until the Oscar ceremony where all the top films are out. This year, you know, I'm looking at things like The Father with Anthony Hopkins, and I'm so excited about these films, and I read somewhere it said due to be released later this year.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, but of course that's all dependent on when the cinemas reopen.
So no, exactly. Yeah, Nomadland is another one. I'd love to see that.
Yeah.
But it's not available here.
Yeah. Do you show films with your students? Is there a practical element to the classes that you teach?
Well, when I teach, in my current role, I'm not doing all that much. I don't do any undergraduate teaching right now. I'll start doing that again once I'm not chair anymore. But I've been teaching religion and film rather than Bible and film. And I teach it even pre-pandemic. I've been teaching that course as a hybrid, partially online, partially in-person course. And I've chosen films that are available on streaming services. And I ask them to see the films themselves, because the way that the classes are set up here, you can't really show a feature film. You know, it just takes up too much time. So I ask them to view it on their own, except once or twice during the semester, we'll watch a film together so that we can talk about the experience of watching a film together, as opposed to watching it by yourself on your iPad, your phone, your computer. So that we can talk about experientially, what does it mean? You know, how does it become, how does it change if it's a collective, a group experience as opposed to an individual experience? But mostly I don't do that. They have to view the film on their own. And then I might show a clip or two if I want to illustrate a point, but it doesn't leave enough time for discussion in our...
No, I agree. And also, of course, watching a film in a classroom is actually almost guaranteed to turn you off the film, because sometimes, whether it's online or at the cinema, everyone has their own kind of, environment that works for them. And I think that you're crossing lots of boundaries. We have on campus a wonderful cinema called the Gulbenkian.
That's lovely.
It's an amazing place, but it used to be, but it's also used for lectures. And sometimes you've got the table in front of you, which can, handy if you're writing notes. But if you're at the cinema of an evening, just sometimes you kind of think it's not quite the same as going to one of the big sort of multiplexes. Oh,
it's not the same as going to the cinema. It really isn't. I mean, there's really nothing like that experience. And you can't duplicate it really anywhere. But I don't know, I've had experiences of showing films in class, even in unoptimal situations, where it's during the day, so even though you close the blinds, there's still some light that seeps through, or the quality of the projection isn't very good. But if it's a really good film, it will still work well enough. And then you can still discuss what it means to see it with other people, but it's not the same as getting at the cinema experience by any means.
Yeah, and I should probably in my own teaching as well revisit that question of the primary means to watching it, because I used to assume, thinking of Clive Marsh's work in this area as well, that people would go to the cinema to watch films, as I do or did. But of course, lockdown has also taught me that there are lots of other ways of engaging with the film. And I remember one of my students actually, who mature student, she was in her late 60s when she did her degree, and she said, but the trouble is, she said, I don't go to the cinema, I don't really watch films. And she said, does that mean she can't do the course? And I said, absolutely not, because there's so much you can get out of the course in terms of the questions that we're raising. But it turned out that she used to go to the cinema when she was young, and suddenly this love of film, this passion came out. And then it turned out that she had this big fascination, I think it was Graham Greene and Brighton Rock, and she wrote about that, and it was so wonderful. I thought, you know, to think that she may even have come close to not taking the module, you know, and I thought the fact that she was drawing nostalgically on something from, you know, 50 years ago actually was, and she may even have looked at the more recent remake, you know, the remake from 10 years ago with Helen Mirren. And I just thought that it just just showed that even when people don't think that they watch films, it's impossible not to be aware, whether you love Star Wars or not. I've never got into it in the way that a lot of my peers have, but you know, you can't live without having those kind of conversations in the school ground or in the university.
No, that's right. You're actually left out of it. And I think for most of us, if we get back to the sort of nostalgia element of this conversation, you know, that for many people, it's the experiences they had in childhood around going to movies that continued on into adulthood, you know. And when I was a child, my parents loved the movies. So we went to lots of movies as a family. And then when we were raising our own kids, we went to lots of movies. And that's something that our kids, even when they were rebellious teenagers, they never objected to going to the movies with us. That was just always something that we enjoyed doing. And now we do that when we see them, which hasn't been for the last more than a year, with our grandkids. So we started taking them also when they were very young. And it became something that we did. That was just something that we did. And so part of it is the feeling of pleasure and the people that you're doing it with. And this is something that you share. And that experience then afterwards, you know, with our grandkids very clearly, you know, it's about getting the snacks at the snack bar and then sitting down. And often now in this where we take them, which is in Boston, there are reclining seats. So then you have to play with the reclining seats. And then you watch the movie and you eat your popcorn. And then, you know, it's just the whole thing of it, the rituals around it, and then the watching it, and then that feeling of being absorbed in it. So I want to tell you, if we're talking about movies, the most indelibly etched experience that we've had. So it was at exactly this time of year, and it was during Passover. So our grandkids are off school during Passover. And I think it must have been about 6 years ago. We took them, our granddaughter was 4 and our grandson was 6. We took them to see the Jungle Book that had come out. And I don't know whether you saw it, the most recent version of the Jungle Book, but it's animated, but it looks very realistic, CGI animated. And we were the only ones in the theater. So our granddaughter and grandson both were frightened out of their minds because the animals looked so real. We tried to point out, and they were sitting on our laps. They were like draped all over us, crying and screaming. And we tried to explain that, listen, these animals are speaking English. So clearly these are not, like, this is just animation. This is really not happening, but it was so realistic. And then we thought, okay, maybe we should just leave. But we didn't want to leave. They didn't want to leave. They couldn't decide. They were screaming and we're so happy we're the only ones in the theater. And then it ended. And our granddaughter, she's wiping her eyes, turned and said, "That was the best movie ever." And we started to laugh. And she said, "Why was that funny?" And it was so interesting because it really showed kind of the the emotional progression, of course, they were, you know, they were completely unfiltered. Most of us, when we go through these emotional progressions, we are filtering through our adult experience, and they wouldn't react that way now, obviously. But it also showed the kind of catharsis at the end, even though I kept reassuring her that everything will be all right. She would be saying, "How do you know? How do you know?" And then everything was all right. So anyway, it was, you know, an interesting experience and put us, of course, in that dilemma, because on the one hand, we wanted them to see it through to the end. But on the other hand, these are our grandkids. We didn't want to kind of traumatize. And we wanted to go to the movies with them again. You know, of course, they continued to. That didn't put them off at all. But anyway, I just wanted to.
I think that is such a magnificent story, because it gets to the heart of the way in which when something you can be a bit fearful of, I suppose it's like the numinous and Otto and this sort of sense of awe, that it strikes a chord. And of course, you look back on that. And in a way, you gloss over something, almost like it was a bad experience, but you came through it okay.
That's right.
And because there was so much emotion invested in it, I mean, the worst emotion in any context, whether it's a lecture or a film or a book, is indifference. Yeah. You know, the worst thing, when you just think, I don't care about this, or I just want to go to sleep. But if something, even if it's really scaring you a bit, then you process that and say, well, why did it have that effect? And then of course, there's a bit of a journey there. But the number of times I've had my own children watching things at the cinema, I think they saw Aladdin a few years ago, and suddenly, even like 6 months later, when he was only he's only five now, so he must have been about three when he saw it, he suddenly said to me, we're at the cinema watching something else, and he said, "Can we see Aladdin tomorrow?" And I was like, "Well, I don't think it's showing tomorrow." He said, "But it's my favorite film," because he'd seen it before. He just assumed that therefore it was always going to be there. So right. I can almost imagine that when he's older, in 20, 30 more years time, he'll remember seeing that at the cinema. Right. It had such an impact on him, and it probably will carry through with him.
I think that's what happens. You know, I've been doing some part of what I'm doing in the second edition of the intro book is adding some resources for people using the book as a text. That's part of what they asked me to do in preparing the second edition, because, you know, like many of us, like us, you know, many people come when they start to teach this material, they're not coming from a film studies background, they're coming from a biblical studies background. And, you know, of course, one acquires, you know, by doing a lot of reading and so on, you acquire some sense of the field of film studies, but that doesn't happen right at the very beginning. So one of the things I'm doing for each chapter is including a kind of a section at the end, you know, 700 to 1,000 words on some aspect of either film theory or film analysis. And for one of the chapters, I think for this chapter, actually, on Christ Figure Films, I'm looking at what's called the sad film paradox. Why do people enjoy sad movies? We don't enjoy feeling sad. We don't enjoy these feelings of terror and so on, that or extreme suspense in events that happen in our lives. But many of us love these sorts of movies. And I was thinking about it because of Judas and the Black Messiah, that you know from the beginning how it's going to end. So why do you subject your, you know, why do we subject ourselves to a movie that we know from the outset is going to make us sad? And so there's a lot of theory around that, around catharsis, around kind of vicarious processing of negative experiences and so on.
Yeah, and I think you've also got to the heart of nostalgia, because it's this wistfulness that nostalgia only works when there's this sense of something, whether it actually did happen or it's in the imagination, but something which we no longer have. And I guess those films, and when your grandchildren are older, they'll probably remember that experience, and it was perhaps, it frightened them, and you were even considered taking them out the cinema. But they'll want to return to that, because it stirred their emotions and it excited them, it motivated them. And I think that I look back, and I've always kept a diary, but I'm glad, because it's a great corrective against sometimes some of those judgments that we make about something that happened so many years ago, and we imagined it was a very happy period. And there may be things in isolation that were very happy, but, you know, at university, I can think of some amazing things that happened. But in the diary, it also says, you know, I'm really stressed about the next essay, or I'm worried whether I'll get a good mark, or I, you know, this is happening. Right. Where will I be living next year? And of course, also you think of things in isolation, but then you see the context, and really, it's not that different to life now. But we just remember sometimes the good bits, and we're nostalgic for those. But would you really want to go back? That's the question.
Well, I wouldn't want to go back to any aspect of my previous life, I don't think. I mean, one of the questions you asked was, are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person? And I'd never really thought about that, but I'm definitely a looking forward kind of person. I don't really dwell. Like now, of course, with my grandkids, I sometimes tell them stories, but it's mostly like to shock them. What? You didn't have a computer? You know, kind of like the, you know, the sense of when I was their age, life was so different. And of course, it doesn't feel like that to me, really. But when I think about it, of course, from their perspective. Yeah. It obviously was, but in my own life, I don't really think back very much. I'm really thinking forward. And that's one of the reasons that this whole pandemic period is kind of difficult, because it's hard to look forward. You know, it's hard to kind of see past our current situation, especially in a country like ours. I think you guys are doing better, maybe, but here, you know, we're still very much behind the eight ball on the vaccination processes and so on. Many of us, even of my advanced age, are not even close to being vaccinated yet. So
yeah, and we're finding that at the moment, because some people, obviously there are always going to be people who break the rules, but we're also finding at the moment that people are being vaccinated, but there are still cases of the virus. Yeah. And even though people may be able to go on holiday in the summer, there won't be any international travel. So
right.
In that sense, it is. So the people who normally would be planning their future, I know people who were due to get married last year and put it off to this year, but Generally we don't. And even if my guess is that they probably will be able to get married, but they won't have the same numbers of people allowed.
Right.
So
it poses a problem, you know, because if you're a forward looking kind of person, then you're always kind of in planning mode and you're thinking about, you know, what's going to be next. And that's one of the things that becomes impossible, you know, at this point.
Yeah. And one of the questions as well was about music, because that was something that just before we started talking, because I always had this obsession with the charts. I sort of, even to this day, I can think, oh yeah, you know, particular periods of my life, I remember the stuff I was listening to, what was on the radio. I mean, the radio, who listens to the radio to the same degree anymore?
Oh, I listen to the radio.
Thank goodness.
not music radio, though. It used to be, we listened, certainly as a teenager, I listened to, you know, top 40, top 100, whatever it was, you know, music radio, AM radio all the time.
Yeah. And, and
now I don't absorb music that way at all.
Can you remember what was in the charts when you were growing up and what sort of?
Well, yeah, I do. I mean, there's certain things that I remember, and there's certain artists that I fell in love with as, you know, their music that are still favorites now. So I remember that the first LP I ever received was a birthday present when I was 11, and it was Simon and Garfunkel's Sounds of Silence. And I still adore Simon and Garfunkel and Paul Simon. I've even managed to see Paul Simon in concert a few times, and I still love that. And then, of course, the Beatles. Well, I was a kid. I remember seeing the Beatles on Ed Sullivan when they first appeared, in Beatlemania and all of that. And then through university, I remember music basically through university. There was Fleetwood Mac and ABBA. And again, these are artists that I still enjoy. Canadian artist Gordon Lightfoot, Joni Mitchell, Bruce Coburn. You don't hear very much about lately, but he was fabulous. And these are people that I grew up in Toronto, that we could go see at some of the I don't even know what they're called, clubs, or, you know, downtown, you know, that they would play in these small smoke-filled venues, and I would go to see them there. And then there was a long period of time that was after I started having kids in the early 80s, that I completely lost track, and I still haven't really caught up to what's happening now. I just haven't caught up. Because there was that whole period of, you know, being absorbed with taking care of kids on the one hand and trying to publish and teach and, you know, have a career on the other hand. didn't leave time for anything except young children's music that we used to play for the kids. So we played a lot of music for our kids, but it was children's music.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed that, but it meant that I lost track of what was playing.
Yeah.
And I like classic. I love classical music as well. I do choral singing. I've always done that. I still do that now virtually, actually with virtual choirs based in England. So I've become much more, my musical life is entirely British based right now.
Yeah. So is that so do you do that, for example, on Zoom? So does everybody come together at the same time and sing?
Yeah, but you don't, it's more complicated than that because you can't sing on, you can't sing together on Zoom while you're listening to other people. And so there are choirs that have really figured out how to do this and how to make music together in a way that makes you feel like you're part of a choir, but the actual experience of it is quite different. So you are, there are live sessions and then there are recording sessions and then it's a whole complicated thing, but it's been quite satisfying. And it reinforces different skills than teaching, than singing in a face-to-face choir does. And that's actually good for a period of time. I mean, I'm looking forward to returning to a face-to-face choir, but for the time being, this has been really fun.
Yeah. And I've got to ask the question as well. How did you end up going into academia? Because obviously you went to university, but was this something that you ever imagined you'd end up doing? Was it an inevitable kind of, you know, follow on from going to university and being intoxicated by the whole world of learning?
Oh, I don't think I was intoxicated by the world of learning. It was more like, what was I going to do? I don't know what I was going to do. Degree in religious studies. It was a matter of buying time. So I applied for a master's program and got in and was offered a lot of money to go and do that. So I went and did that. And that's what turned me towards New Testament studies, actually, because I wanted to go on in early, I had a degree in Jewish studies. I wanted to continue in early Judaism, Second Temple Judaism, early rabbinics. I studied a lot of, you know, my Hebrew was good, and so wanted to go on and do that. And I got accepted to McMaster, which had a program in early Judaism, but you also had to study Christianity at the same time and vice versa. And so I took a course in my first year. I had to pick up Greek over the summer because I hadn't studied Greek. I had done 4 years of Hebrew, but no Greek because I had no inkling of, I'd never even read the New Testament before. And didn't really see myself as, that just wasn't on my horizon at all. But then I had to do a course on Galatians with Ed Sanders. And so I had to do a crash course in Greek over the summer before starting. And, you know, Ed Sanders was quite an electrifying teacher. And this was exactly the same time when he submitted the manuscript for Paul and Palestinian Judaism.
I looked at his work when I was at E.P. Sanders.
E.P. Sanders, yeah. Yeah, so he was teaching at McMaster at the time. And he made it all very exciting and really brought it alive. And then I got this idea that it could be a very cool thing for a Jewish person to do, or somebody with Jewish, not just being Jewish, but with a you know, primary background in Jewish studies. And so I had that idea that that would be kind of cool. I didn't know anybody else who had done that. And at the time, actually, there were a few people, but I didn't know them yet. I didn't know them until long afterwards. And so that's when I got that idea. And then I went on to a PhD there, but I wasn't necessarily committed to that. I started thinking about other career paths early on in my PhD because I wasn't sure that this is what I wanted to do. It was already at that time difficult to get a job, so I didn't think I would get a job. And so I applied to other things. I applied and got into social work school and decided that that wasn't for me. I applied and got into law school. And I would have done that, except that after I applied and got in, I discovered that we were expecting our first child, who was due the first week of classes the following September. And I just couldn't see how I was going to do that, go to law school and have a baby and do all of that. But I could already see how I could finish my PhD. So that's what I ended up doing. And so it was kind of, I say this, I don't know, I did the SBL presidential address this year. I kind of outlined that because I just wanted to emphasize that it wasn't like I had this mission to go and do this. It was just something that I ended up doing and haven't regretted. It's been a blast and it remains fascinating to me. But it wasn't like I went in there with this passion to do this work. It was more like, well, I want to have a career. I've already started this. Here I am going to have, starting our family. And so I could imagine combining an academic career with raising children. I couldn't get my mind around a legal career. So I finished.
Yeah, it's funny. So many of the people that I've interviewed have a similar story to tell, really, which is that they didn't necessarily imagine that, even if now they are at the top of their game and they're known maybe internationally for the work that they do, you see this sense of inevitability. And I guess it links to what we were saying earlier about nostalgia, about putting a gloss on the past and imagining that, something was very important when it's important because it suits our particular purposes and needs. But I think that's very telling that sometimes, if you'd done something completely different, if you'd been in law, you'd have had a very successful career, but doing something very different. But it's
Yeah,
but
exactly.
you but sometimes it's hard to imagine how there's almost this, we use the language sometimes of fate or being almost like destined to do something. It's like, well, you've achieved this thing, you were meant to do it. But I don't know, because looking back in time, it's as I say, back to what I was saying about keeping a diary. It's great when you can actually look at the entries and you had no idea what you were going to do, but you can read back from the present just as you want to. And of course that can enforce this myth almost then of this almost this journey which has one particular destination in mind. It's a fallacy.
Yeah, well, in my case, I never had that myth, I guess. And maybe that goes along with not really being a nostalgic person. It's not that I'm incapable of nostalgia. A few months ago, we were in Toronto and wandered around the neighborhood that we lived in, when we got married and had our first couple of kids. And I felt nostalgic, not really for that time so much as, how much fun it was to live in that neighborhood and, more fun than living in a suburb in Ottawa. But generally I'm not, so I don't have that sense of inevitability at all. I easily could see how I could have been something else. Any number of different things. It's just that this is how it panned out. One thing led to another, and this is how it panned out. And it's not that I regret it either. It's been a very fulfilling path. But it doesn't feel like it doesn't have that sense of inevitability to it, or that it's rooted in, some sort of primordial experiences that I had. It doesn't feel that way to me.
But it may be particular teachers who inspired you, because you mentioned E.P. Saunders, but I'm guessing as well. I mean, I find when I'm teaching that there's a sense of channeling the people in terms of content, but also mode of delivery sometimes with the people who inspired you, that you kind of feel, as an undergraduate, this really excited me and motivated me. And you kind of feel that when you're with your own undergraduate sometimes, that a lot of that is being imparted to, as it were, the next generation.
Yeah. I don't know if I feel that. I mean, I enjoy teaching. I try to make it lively. I've had a lot of decent teachers, but maybe it's because I've just been doing this for such a long time. This is my 40th year of full-time teaching now that I'm finishing. So I think by now, I'm not really challenging any, channeling anybody. It just feels like I have a style, I have a way of being in the classroom, and I'm just doing that, And of course, adjusting to Zoom has been different as well. How do you convey that sense of vitality that one tries to bring to the classroom, and that sense of being a real person in front of, these other real people is more challenging in this kind of medium.
Yeah, I found that because I was very daunted by it at first, because I was used to standing in front of a class of you know, 18-year-olds or however old, and that would be sort of my modus operandi. But now, of course, we have to pre-record lectures. The seminars are live, again, over Zoom. But I'd be pre-recording them. And first of all, I thought, oh, I'll run out of things to say after half an hour, whereas I can sustain it for 2 hours in the class. The opposite happened. I would just be going on. And if anything, I was speaking for longer because I could, because I wasn't up against the clock in the same way, or I wouldn't be looking at the clock. And I do it in segments in case something went horribly wrong, so I wouldn't lose more than 20 minutes of my talk. Yeah. But also, see, it's interesting because I always had this different sort of journey, because although obviously I work in academia, it wasn't whatever I imagined I'd do. I always imagined it would be something in radio, because that was my passion when I was young. And that's never gone away. So I kind of feel that there's the safe path, the inevitable path, and the one that I've taken, which to people who don't know me very well think, you know, that's all they know about me. But there's another path, which I think other people, even it's funny, even through doing these interviews, people who I went to school with sometimes, or people who knew me in the past, who will sometimes say, oh, but you know, that it always seemed that something in radio was the thing that I might end up doing. So somewhere along the way, I don't regret anything that I've done in the last 20, 30 years, but I do feel that there is something else which in some way I'd like to channel, which I guess I am doing through this
podcast. Right. You're obviously doing it, right? So there are different ways to do that now. Yeah. So
I'm using that language of inevitability, but often maybe I'm thinking of my own journey.
You know, I think for some people it's like that. You know, I think there are, you know, my brother, ever since he was a child, he wanted to be a doctor. Well, he's a doctor, you know, so he just... It's just what he always wanted. He never really questioned it. His interests have remained constant. And that's true of his interests outside the his profession as well. I've been singing since I was a child. That's always been part of my life. But I never kidded myself that I would have been good enough or really interested in a professional career. That's not what it's about. It was just something that I had fun doing. So, you know, so that's it. You know, so my continuing in that is something that I can trace back to my childhood, but it's not something I would ever have dreamed of doing in a professional way. The fun of it is that I don't have to be, you know, I just have to be good enough at it to sing in a choir. I don't have to be good in some objective sense, the way that I want to be in my academic field.
Yeah. What about other things at university? Because you mentioned already that your sport was never your thing, and certainly that would be my answer as well. But politics, indeed, religion, obviously you were studying religion. And, you know, what about the sort of various forces and influences, whether it was music, film, religion, politics, you know, as you were growing up?
Well, music, I mean, through elementary school, high school, university, I sang in the choirs at those institutions. I went to University of Toronto, and I sang in the Hart House Chorus, which was a fantastic choir. We went on tour. We did all kinds of really interesting things. And that was really amazing. But my love of that really began truly in high school, where we had an amazing choral program. And we our high school choir won top prize in all of the, you know, Ontario competitions and did all the big things. So that's what made it very exciting for me. I continued that through university. I didn't get involved in politics. Film was just a pastime. I did one course. The course I did the worst at university was a film course on Ingmar Bergman's films. And I went to the movies and I found the movies interesting. And the only assignment for the course was to write our own screenplay. And mine was terrible. So I got, I don't know, 60 or something on that, which thankfully, you know, was anomalous in my academic record. Otherwise, I never would have gotten into graduate school. Yeah. But yeah, I don't, you know, I hung out with friends. I, you know, I did those kinds of things. I was, you know, I got good marks in school, but I wasn't kind of, aside from choir, I didn't really do any other formal activities, except, you know, spend a lot of time with friends and that kind of thing, have a good time.
And as we start, just a few more, should we say, philosophically based questions as we start to wrap up. But would you say, Adele, that your memories are predominantly positive as you look back on your life and career?
Yes, I would say so. I mean, it's not that there aren't things that I regret and things that were negative, but when I look back, yeah, my memories are primarily positive. I had a happy childhood. I've enjoyed my life and what I've done, and I have enduring friendships and, enduring relationships, past the half century point at this point. I feel that despite the haphazardness of how I got to this career point, I am happy with where I'm at and what I've done. And I feel that I've done some good in some, in a very limited sphere, but still.
And it's worth saying as well, because I spoke to someone who did a PhD with me. I was the examiner, but she was doing it at my university a few years ago, and she did a master's course 15 years ago, and she was using your work as the basis for one of her essays. And I said, oh, by the way, I'm interviewing you today. And she was like, I seem to, and suddenly for her, this essay, and she hadn't thought about that essay in 15 years, but suddenly it was sort of like, I remember now that particular journey. So it's funny along the way how I find it. Sometimes I get Facebook can do it sometimes as well, but you get almost sort of random inquiries from people. You made some great difference, but
you don't really know that, right? And we know that in our own lives too, that there are things that we've read or things that we've seen or people that we've heard speak that really had an impact. And sometimes we get to meet them and become friends with them, and most often we don't, so we don't really know that.
And of course the related question there about negative experiences and being nostalgic for things, because if something worked out really well in the end, it's like the film that you took your grandchildren to,
right?
Because in the end it had a quote happy ending, or not necessarily the film, although obviously it did,
but the experience,
the experience was happy.
Yeah,
at the time you were probably, for three quarters of the film, you were thinking, oh, have we made a big mistake?
Oh, absolutely.
But now you remember it as being a very positive experience, because it was corroborated by your grandchildren, by the sound.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, mostly we remember it as a hilarious experience of this child who was sobbing and then said it was the best movie ever when she'd been so upset the whole movie. But yes, it was a positive experience. And also, I suppose it was positive because it validated our inclination not to leave the movie. And then, and then the fact that there was nobody else there also meant we didn't have to worry about who we were disturbing, right? So, which is another factor when you go to see a movie in a public space like a theater. Mm. But yeah, I think nostalgia is a complicated thing, right? And even if you are, it can go both ways. So even if you know that there are decisions that you made, I've certainly made decisions that I shouldn't have made, that set a certain process, set a certain direction for you in a way. You can look back and think that that was a decision, you shouldn't have done that. But the outcomes of that are not necessarily negative, even though you know you shouldn't have done it, made a certain career choice or, switched something or other at a certain point, but the outcomes can be positive outcomes. So it becomes a complicated question about nostalgia and negative events and things like that. And I wouldn't say that I feel nostalgic about such events, but my evaluation of them changes over time.
Yeah, and it's the same with some of the films that we were just talking about as well, because sometimes people say to me, are you sure that you want to watch this particular film, or is it a bit too personal or a bit too challenging, or is it too closely based to experiences you've had? And sometimes I think, well, actually, that's the reason to watch it, because it's giving me almost, it's endorsing that sense that something here isn't right, and the filmmakers are finding their own ways.
Yeah, I mean,
and it's helping me answer them along the way. So rather than shut up, I say I need to watch this because it's going to help recalibrate me in some way.
Yeah. No, I think that there are definitely times in our lives when something that we read or something that we watch can be a way of clarifying our own feelings and thoughts about a situation. I think that that definitely can happen. But, you know, I face that now too, in a way, because my mother's 94 and she has severe dementia. And there are all of these films like The Father that we were just talking about and other films about that experience. And I can't watch those films because I am living that experience now, not for myself, thankfully. And of course, the specter of that happening is there, especially when you see it in a parent who was once so intelligent and lively. And, you know, when you see them kind of lose their personality and their memories, you know that it can happen to anybody, including oneself. Mm. I can't watch those movies right now because I fear that they take me through an experience that I experience every day anyway. And I don't need that. It's not something that I need to do right now. Maybe at some point in the future, I'll be able to do it, but I can't. And so even though I know The Father is supposed to be a fantastic movie, I'm not going to see it.
Yeah, but I think what you say is absolutely right, because sometimes the right time and the right place and the right people, and there's all sorts of reasons, and it's the accidental stumbling on something that really hits a nerve, and then there's also the physically and actively going out in search of something when mm-hmm. you know, and there's a line there, and I think sometimes it's actually right just to say this may be very good and there may be a time in the future, but actually at this moment, why should you? And I think agency is important. The thing that I find hard sometimes when people will just sort of randomly, if you're looking on Netflix or something and people will say, I don't know what to watch, but I'll watch something for 5 minutes, I'll go to something else. For me, there needs to be some sense of, you know, this is the right thing, but then you settle with it and
that's
you stick
right.
But you have the power to say, I'm not watching this. And
that's
and
right.
You need to have, it can't be a random experience, but you need agency to be part of
that's
that.
That's right. And there are times when suddenly it's the same about movies that involve the death of children, for example. Yeah. You know, sometimes you're watching a movie and you're blindsided by that happening. If that's something that's happening in that movie, I stop watching the movie. Yeah. I just know I don't need to take myself through that emotional experience. Yeah.
No, absolutely.
And, you know, and it's interesting, you know, it happens to me also with Holocaust movies. My parents were Holocaust survivors. And it was always fascinating to me that they went to see every single Holocaust movie. And I couldn't stand to do it. Yeah. And now I've watched a few, some of the ones that are kind of less graphic in terms of the actual experience, but explore other aspects. You know, I have been able to watch those or, you know, after the aftermath, you know, people rebuilding their lives afterwards and so on. Yeah. But it was just fascinating to me that my parents who had lived through this felt that, you know, they wanted to see, and they went to see these films because they wanted to see how that experience was being portrayed on film. What were other people seeing about that? And that they would judge these films on that basis. But I just said, not doing that, not watching those movies.
And was that something that you were able to, I mean, obviously, so your parents would watch these films, but would you have conversations with them as well about this?
Yes.
Be open about? Hmm.
Yes, that's right. And I remember especially, or in particular, well, Schindler's List was one film that we talked about quite a bit, but also It's a Beautiful Life, right? I think that was the name.
Oh, the Roberto Benigni film, yeah.
Yeah, and there was a lot of controversy around that film because it was a comedy. And I remember that, you know, we talked about that quite a bit. They were very, I mean, one of the things that I am nostalgic about or that I remember very, with a lot of warm feelings is, you know, decades of going to the movies with them and the conversations afterwards about the films. They were very thoughtful people and they quite liked the film. I mean, they understood why people would, or even their friends, you know, most of whom were also Holocaust survivors, you know, would find that problematic. Like, how can you make a comedy about it? Mm. But they were, you know, they thought it worked. They thought it worked. And I also thought it did. Mm. That making a comedy about it was not making light of it. Yeah. And they could see that distinction.
Yeah, I remember how it really polarized people, because it was in the Golden Globes, you know, when they separate the comedy strip musical and then the drama.
Right, right.
And they put it in the drama category. And yeah. And it was sort of like almost as though, because they didn't want it to be seen as a comedy, but it was right. A comedy, but it was a serious comedy, which is an oxymoron. Yeah. And I think it was maybe Jack Nicholson was up for something that year. And maybe it was about Schmidt or something. Anyway, something, it was around that period. And he then said, you know, I thought, and he was nominated the other way. And he was like, I thought we'd made a comedy. And, you know, but it right. was always this sort of thing about, and I think you're right, because the word comedy suggests something almost trivial.
Right.
But in reality, comedy, as you find with Woody Allen or the Coen brothers, can actually be a portal into wisdom. And it's a very...
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, now when you go onto Netflix now, you see... films being described as comedies or tragic comedies or, you know, so the genres are much harder to differentiate. And I always think about the film Stranger Than Fiction. Did you see that movie?
You know, I was talking about that just yesterday because I saw Dustin Hoffman and Emma Thompson in Last Chance Harvey just last night. And I was...
Oh, I haven't seen that.
And I was thinking just not too many hours before we started this interview, I thought I must watch Stranger Than Fiction soon. So please.
Oh, it's such a great movie. Mm. But Dustin Hoffman plays an English professor and he defines tragedy and comedy. Oh, tragedy, the hero dies. Comedy, he gets hitched. So, you know, but it's, and that's helpful actually. That is a kind of a formal definition, but many films now don't fit easily. You know, when we think about the genre definitions, this whole question of genre, of course, right, is a very complex question. But I think when it comes to differentiating tragedy and comedy, it's not so easy.
Yeah. And I just had one more question because you answered one of my questions anyway about being looking back or looking forward, but and not least through things like Facebook. Are you in touch with friends? And I guess not least because of lockdown with family, you know, from your past, do you find
you're able to
very much stay in touch with
people? Oh, yes. Well, certainly with family, I'm in touch with my family, you know, with my immediate family, my extended family. Yeah. But also with friends. I've maintained friendships, not from elementary school because we moved towards the end of elementary school. Although I do have one friend from that time who also is a high school friend. But some of my closest friends are people that I've known since high school. And with one friend in particular, I think we've known each other. We've been very close friends, I would say now for 57 years. So I've got university friends. I certainly have, you know, graduate school friends and from different places. You know, we've lived in different places. So and lockdown or this period of time has brought me back in touch or in more regular touch with people whom I used to see when I would travel to different places. But now I can't see them. So we keep in touch in that way. But yeah, still have a lot of people who've... you know, kind of accompanied my adolescent and adult life for sure.
Well, and we've come full circle because we were talking about happy endings, and I think you've just indicated that, like with Stranger Than Fiction, and the line between the REAL and the REEL, you know, then
that's right.
It sounds like a very very, very accomplished life and career, and a very nice sort of way of bringing everything full circle. But Adele, it has been so tremendous to catch up with you. Thank you for being my guest.
It was a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me, and. It was really fun chatting with you, and I hope that someday we'll get to see each other again in person.